Hey, the music featured in this episode is from Rob Malatek's CD, Back Home. Enjoy. Hi, and welcome to Musicians Real Talk. I'm your host, Glenn Douglas. Musicians Real Talk is a podcast which serves to provide life stories and information about musicians performing in and around the Washington, Maryland, and Virginia areas. So you understand, musicians, we arrive at the job, we exchange greetings, we perform, we break down, and eventually we go our separate ways. Rarely do we engage in our life stories or share in conceptual devices which contribute to our approach to this thing called music. The Musicians Real Talk podcast aims to fill that void. Hey, and welcome to part two of my conversation with Dejanal Boykin. In this episode, we will cover the creation of Luther Relives. We will talk about how, with a positive approach, Dejanal has been able to build the Luther Relives tribute into a very successful brand. We will also cover what the future looks like for the music industry. Everyone, welcome to part two of my conversation with Dejanal Boykin. Let's talk about Luther Relives.
I heard about that.
well, for the listeners who don't know, can you tell us what is Luther Relives?
Luther Relives, in a couple words, is a tribute to the great late Luther Vandross. And I probably should start by saying what I get asked all the time. Why not just call it a tribute? I don't like calling it a tribute. I don't think we operate in a tribute relative to what most people view and interpret a tribute, because you will often see people singing or performing someone's song and call it a tribute. But Luther Relives, and I understand Relives may not be grammatically correct, but it was consciously selected because my whole plan and strategy was to relive that Luther experience. Not just sing his songs, not just have, you know, some good music, but to relive that experience in that time. And those of you who are familiar with Luther Vandross, and I suspect most everyone is, know that he was known for several things, just a few of them. He was very flamboyant. He had beautiful girls and backup singers. He was known for choreography. He was known for the costumes and multiple changes throughout. He was known for some of the greatest love songs and some of the funkiest tunes. And I particularly like the balance in the arrangements and so forth as it applied to the bass and the other instruments. Many of you know that Marcus was the driving factor early on with both the arrangements and producing and writing. And so I love some Marcus, and right. You know, and I think if I really listen to some of the early arrangements, it reminded me of some kind of the Motown arrangements, and you okay. know, back to mm-hmm. kind of the Jameson feel and so right. forth, like a Any Love kind of thing, right? But I met William Wardlaw, get this, at the Classics nightclub. So many of the D.C. area listeners yeah. will automatically gravitate to how long that's been, because it's been closed, 20 years? So he and I, which he is the lead singer, met about, 25, 26 years ago. And we did some recording. We did some writing together. We did a few jingles. We worked on a couple albums. And we kind of grew to each other. Again, the analogy I would try to compare is the one that Marcus had with Luther, and you know, me being similar with the bass and so forth. I was driving him, pushing him. We were doing arrangements, and we just kind of melted together. And we developed. We start finishing each other's sentences, and you know, I kind of referenced this before, and the kind of person I am, I have to have chemistry. One of my favorite sayings is, this is not Chick Corea stuff. And those right. that may not know Chick Corea, I mean, he to me was a very complicated musician with many of his arrangements and notes. This is not that. This is feel good stuff, right? This okay. is mm-hmm. chemistry. This is how you can melt into each other. This is how you can bring tears to my eyes when I hear that, or make you put on that face like you're smelling doo-doo or something like that, right? And it comes from the group. It comes from the sum of the whole. And so as we start melting more together, we start talking about doing this Luther thing. He just happens to look like Luther. Again, this is not an impersonation thing. They say everyone has a twin. He happens to look like him. He talks like him. He laughs like him. And he sings like him. His weight even goes up and down like Luther. And I don't know you can plan that. So I kind of pushed him to let's do this Luther thing. And it's funny that I remember the first year I used the name Luther Relives, and I actually wrote out a different name that I was going to use every year was the original plan. The second year, I think, was going to be Luther Reignited, and the third one was something else. But people kept pulling that back, right? Mm-hmm. Again, that's from the audience perspective. They like, what is Luther Relives doing? And I even had cards, Luther Reignited. I'm not using that anymore. And we want Luther Relives. So it okay. kind of stuck. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, let's keep it. But it got started that way. I had probably three or four sets of musicians, both individually and group-wise, that just didn't give me the chemistry I wanted. I knew how I had to feel. I didn't know exactly what I wanted, but I knew how I had to feel, both from individual players and, more importantly, from the sum of the whole. And it would speak for itself. So I went through a few to what I've had now. And Mr. Glenn Douglas is a part of that, and I am privileged to have him. And by the way, if you've seen us perform, you see me or hear me introduce him as the longest living person on this earth that I know. And the reason is because aside from my parents that are now deceased, I've known Glenn longer than anyone else. We went to elementary school.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And so I feel extra privileged to, again, be able to tap into that empathy, to that warmth, that color. I mean, we just vibe. We always have. I mean, Glenn actually did the first Luther gig with me, right? Back at the Carlisle, the one that I would call What We Had Luther.
Right.
And he went on his own for a while. And by the way, it really wasn't all together. It was just the first one, and it was one of several building blocks. But he did one of the first. He went away. And I am so pleased and honored that he would choose to come back to me, because it is that kind of color and that kind of a contribution that he brings that I think rounds off my chemistry. But we have all these chemists.
Yes, we do.
And we have fun together. We actually like each other.
We go doing
all kinds of things. And I know some of you musicians out there, I'm taking my stuff, then I'm going home, I don't want to see them. I remember we joke sometimes, you be in band, like, man, you better get him, tell him, don't say nothing to me anymore, it's going to be on, right? We don't have that, right?
Right.
We don't have that. But what we do is we push each other. We respect each other. Everybody has a voice, right? This is not about my show or even the lead singer's show. Again, this is a group statement.
Right. I want to go back a little bit.
Okay. Because
you said something. And you talked about Luther's flamboyance, mm-hmm. and the way he, even how he developed his shows and all that. I don't think a lot of people know this, but Luther learned all of that from working with the late David Bowie.
Right.
That's where he and David Bowie was one of the people who pushed Luther to go out and be a solo artist, because he set him up where he would open up for David Bowie, and he would do maybe about four or five tunes, maybe about three or four tunes, And at first they said, man, the people would boo him.
Yeah.
They were like, who is this dude? We want David Bowie.
But you're right. I mean, Luther is a history lesson within itself.
Yes,
on
it is.
Every
yes, it is.
Aspect. And you know, it's hard for me to even talk about it without tears coming to my eyes, because if you understand his story and what he's doing and how it plays and interact with the other pieces, with the business, you go on and on, then you get it, right? And without that, you're going to miss it, a la The Experience, Relives. You can't do one without, you can't just learn the song or learn the music and sing it and then call that. And I actually get offended sometimes when they say tribute, not because it's a bad word, but because I think we've given it a bad word. When you do a tribute to someone, it's supposed to be honoring them. It's supposed to be a reflection on all the goodness and the warmth in their life. And not that many singers don't do that, but I think they're missing components when you only sing their song and call it a tribute.
Sometimes, man, I really think that when I hear about tributes, I even go as far as I'll go as far as to say this. I wonder how many of these people that are saying they're doing tributes to someone actually go back and research these people to find out what it took for these people to get where they are, or get where they were. I'm talking about the struggles and the whole nine yards, the things that they went through, and how they evolved to this point.
You can't do one without the other. I mean, to that point, I think I know everyone know that Luther was ill, but we dabbed into that even underneath, you know, his struggles with weight, his struggle with diabetes, his struggle with eating challenges and so forth. And we did a podcast on that and became part of that. But to really understand that, I think gives you head and shoulders opportunity to really make the statement. Because remember, music and performance is communication. It's a statement, often a statement of your heart, often a statement of your struggles and your interactions and all that. So my argument would be, how could you effectively do that unless you understand it?
Yeah. If you don't understand the whole part of the person, how can you go and say you're doing a tribute?
We spent a lot of time on that. Uh-huh. And I think the growth and the patronage has reflected the hard work that we've collectively put in that.
Hey, I want to switch gears here. What are your roles in the Luther Relives project, and how have these roles evolved over time?
I'm laughing at what seems to be a simple question, because I'll start with my most famous role. We were doing a show in, I think it was Bethesda Blues and Jazz, and I had put my equipment up. I ran to park, and then I was going back, so I had on my jeans and street clothes and so forth. And it was a sold-out show, and it was a lady rushing the park, and she saw me walking up the driveway, and she says, can you park my car? And I said, no, but parking's right around there. And I said, are you going to the show? And she said, yeah, I got to see him. I said, well, what is your name? She said, Nancy. I said, okay, well, I hope you enjoy the show. So she rolls around there. And then after that show, what we always do, we have the singers, and sometime I will go in the back, we'll sign autographs, give out cards and all that. So I saw the lady there getting a signature and autograph. So I said, hi, Nancy. She says, how do you know my name? I said, because you asked me to park your car. And so, of course, I had on my hat and my performance clothes. So that's one of my many roles. My primary role is bassist for the group. I'm also a music director, and I'm also a manager. And, you know, I wash dishes. I'm a booking agent. I walk around with a roll of toilet tissue, if you know what I mean. I mean, I do what I need to do to get it done, because, again, it's the sum of the whole.
Right.
And my goal and my role is motivator and facilitator.
Right.
And there are many things in that that I know I have to do that may be a little outside of my defined role, if it's even defined, that that is done because I need to continually earn the right to be a leader. You're not given that right just because you start a group or just because you know more notes than someone. Right. I got to earn that. I got to earn it every day with every transaction, because anything I do to detract from that puts a question mark in someone's mind that will later come back to be a lessening link in the chain. And my goal is to strengthen this chain with every transaction we do, whether it's rehearsal, whether we're kicking it and playing, whether we're performing, whether we're planning and talking, whether we're traveling. That's how you do it. Because think about it. To not do that, and if you reflect on some of the groups on why John is not here, Joe is not there, whether or why it's contention, I think you will see some of that. And, you know, my role, my talent is having forethought, is looking down the road. What is the end result that I'm trying to achieve? Because many times the little transactions could be a trip in the road. They could facilitate it or they may detract from it. But you got to look at the end result, and you got to you got to execute a plan that's going to get you there and not just over every little step, or you'll find yourself zigzagging.
Right.
I think that's so important there.
What are some of the roadblocks or issues you've had to overcome to garner the success you're experiencing now with Luther Relives?
there are a few.
there are a few. Okay.
I don't know that I would call them roadblocks, so to speak. As a matter of fact, you and I talked about this unknowingly, but I look at I don't look at things as a roadblock or challenge, so to speak. I look at them as a learning experience, because if you really absorb something that deflects or derails whatever your goal was, whether it was a musical goal, whether it was a particular gig, whether it was hiring somebody, whether it was making some money, there's education in there for you if you open your eyes.
Yes, it is. Yes,
absolutely. It is. And yes, so, I mean, I can think of a number of things that's happened, from missing a wrong note to maybe not having all the right T's and C's in the contract to... I was laughing at first because when you asked me the biggest roadblock, my response was going to say haters. And they're there. But you know what? They provided some of the best lemonade stories that I've ever had. And for those of you who may not know what we refer to a lemonade story, you know, you get lemons. It's like, oh, my God, this is broke. It's not going to work. I don't know what to do. But put some sugar in and stir it up. You'll like it. And right. Like, I will give you this.
Well, if it has too much sugar in it, pour some water in.
Exactly. No, but you're right. You got to make it palatable. But right. But I have so many of these lemonade stories. But just one quick one that is added to our growth and popularity. Stephen Hill, a senior VP with BET, was at the Soul Train Cruise when we did it last year, and I walked by him, and he said, "Hey, man," he said, nice work playing bass." And I said, "Oh, you were there?" He says, "Yeah, I was up front." And he said, "I came there to hate," and I laughed. I said, "He said, no, I'm serious. I came there to hate, to see what y'all can't do, because nobody does Luther." I've heard that so many times,
right,
and
right.
And his response then was, "And I fell in love, and I was done." I've heard that so many times.
Right.
A lady named Miss Patty Lacey said the same thing. She used to sing with Luther. She came to hate, say, "They can't do that. Let me see what they can do." Well, she's been touring with us.
Right.
So and they've given their approval for us to market that. So, you know, there are many, many challenges, if you want to define it as that. But my goal is to flip that. Right. I want to find out, and I got this from my father. Why didn't it work? Why didn't I get 100 on that score? Why didn't you like it?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, clearly you can't change everybody's mind and everybody's thought, but you will be a bigger, stronger, more effective leader if you understand it and understand what didn't happen and why. You may make a conscious decision to not change, but when you understand it, you're on your way.
Let me ask you this question. Do you have an ego? And if you do, what is your ego for?
Wow, man, that's a loaded one.
Yes, it is.
You know, had you asked me that a few years back, I probably would have said no. But I think if I'm being honest with myself, I would have to say yes. And I think I would have to say that's a good thing. And the reason I think, and
no, go ahead.
You know, is the ego part of it, if I'm going to use my own definition, allows me to have the gazoolas and the drive and the confidence to say, here's me, here's my product, I am worth X, and here's my rider, here's my requirements. It ain't no more dressing in the bathroom, right?
Right.
I need meals because we've been traveling. No, I'm not going to stay in a roach motel, right? So from an ego there, yes, I will get up in your face, and it's because I'm representing my people. They work hard. I work them hard. I got minimum requirements for them, from pay all the way down to dressing room, guests, travel, all that. Yes, I do. We work hard because you know what? All that stuff I told you about understanding the marketplace, I'm going to sell your place out. I'm going to put you on the map. Mm-hmm. And so it's a win-win.
Well, and here's the reason why I asked that question. It's because Bill Russell's book, Russell's Rules,
mm-hmm.
He has a chapter in there about the ego.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, and in there he was saying how everyone has an ego, mm-hmm. but what is your ego for?
Mm-hmm.
He said he was asked about his ego, and he said, yeah, I have a big ego. I have a big ego. He said, but my ego isn't about me. My ego is the team. If the team plays well, I have a big ego.
Yeah.
We beat everybody.
We did it.
Yeah, we did it. And as I was listening to you in our conversation, a lot of it, you talk about we.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the reason why I wanted to bring that out. I think that's something that listeners need to hear. They need to know that, hey, look, it's okay to have an ego,
yeah.
but what is your ego for?
Right, right.
It's okay to be able to, and I want to, and honestly, I work for you. If you didn't have an ego about what we do, what we're doing has no value.
It has no value. or you become impeded in placing it where it needs to go. You got to have that drive. And again, my scenario about McDonald's and Pepsi, they're always in your face. Somebody got to have, quote, that ego to represent us. Again, you can't sit in your vacuum and play 99 notes and, okay, man, the whole world's coming to me.
Okay. First as a musician, then as a manager. What changes do you see happening in music? And do you see a positive outlook in the current direction of music?
Interesting question and interesting timing in that question, because we're privileged to be on right on the edge of releasing our album. We're in the studio a lot. We're creating a lot. And this relative to his question is, again, what is the marketplace? If you listen to radio now, you will go here, there. I'm not sure where you go, but you'll go where you probably are not really focused on as a music, right? So part of me is, where's the market now? Where's the market going? And a lot of me is, where do I think they need to go? Because I'm back to this feel-good live music, and that's really been lost a lot lately.
Well, you know, we recently performed at a festival, and it appeared, man, that 60%, maybe more, of the entertainers were using tracks. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Tracks. Whew, that's a four-letter word. Woo. And unfortunately, it sounded like track. They wasn't. Many of them weren't very good. It didn't. They didn't put the human effort or input in it.
Yeah,
I had a problem with that.
Yeah, I did too. Matter of fact, I'm not going to name the artist. I'm not going to name the artist, but within the first 5 minutes of their performance, I got up and I walked out.
Yeah, it was painful
because it insulted my intelligence.
Well, but I'm just saying but like that. Further, again, this is one of my marketplace statements. I went on a mission to understand the patron's perspective on that. And the demographics are in an age group much like ours. They're very dedicated. They stay from start to finish. They know what they want. They know what they need. And it's an insult to them. But it was refreshing to hear that we quickly rose and are at the top because of just that. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned the recording project because I am immixed in this right now like you wouldn't believe. I'm doing some testing with radio promoters or PDs or MDs to understand that, because for me to do all this great stuff here and nobody will play it doesn't do me any good.
Or
vice versa. For me to just simply sell out what I've been sitting here preaching about chemistry and, you know, warmth and all that, and just do some tracks, that doesn't get it either. So, you know, to your question about music director and manager, that's what I'm involved in right now. And I got to understand it and I got to get it right, because I think we have a lot to offer. And we've already proven that the people want to hear us. I just got to put some magic dust in between there so we do both. And I think I got my arms around it.
Good, good. What advice would you give to someone looking to music as a serious career path? Now, this is very interesting, especially coming from a person whose father was saying, look, you're not doing music. But what advice would you give someone?
Well, but again, you know, just like I finished saying, you know, anything that gets in your way. Somebody says don't do. Somebody says hate. Somebody says you can't do it here. You got to find out why, number one. And you gotta really, really be open-minded about it. Because sometimes we listen to only hear what we want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not listening. You have to be an active listener and hopefully be the empath. Because when you are, you can hear it, see it, and feel it from somebody else's perspective. You may not agree with it, but at least you understand why they say what they say, and then use that and construct your path. And remember, as we talked about, the path is not the 99 notes. The path is where are you going, and what do you want it to say, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a club musician, and there's nothing wrong with that, if that in fact is your goal, but if you want to play Carnegie Hall, there's a certain criteria, right?
Right.
And you got, I mean, it start. You can't. I don't know a lot of trios that get a lot of playtime in Carnegie Hall. I'm sure there's some, but it's kind of like the person who comes out of high school that wants to get in the NBA or all that. You got to look at the odds. You got to look at what it takes, right? You got to look at the whole piece of it and construct your path.
I hope you've enjoyed part two of my conversation with Detrinal Boykins. I'd like to thank Rob Maletic for providing the background music for this episode. If you'd like to know more about Rob and his music, please go to www.robmaletic.com. That's www.robmaletic.com. And for more episodes of the Musicians Real Talk podcast, you can go to my website at www.glendouglasmusic.com. That's www.glendouglasmusic.com. And remember, music is God's gift to the world. It is not your invention. Thank you.